police officers. Feel free to raise your hand. We'll give you the 2 minutes. If it's something that we can address or our commander can address, we'll turn the table over to him and he will address it for you guys. This is not city services, so if it's regarding something city service-wise, Barbara's here. I'm sure she would love to help you guys out afterwards. But again, no city services, only policing and interactions with police officers here in the 8th District. So does anyone have any questions, comments, or would like the floor for 2 minutes for a public comment or questions? Nope. All right, Rosa noted, no current public comments. Last month, we did have 2 public comments. One was via email, and one was at an actual meeting. The first one, it was in regards to the 18th Ward over off of 79th and Trip. I'm not going to give a specific address. I've shared it with the commander and his leadership team. They have a resident who was unhappy with the calls for service that she got, pertaining to officers coming to her house when vehicles were blocking the sidewalk and a noise complaint. We took that complaint and the photos that she presented, and we turned it over to Commander and Sergeant Malloy, and they responded back to us with via email stating that they were going to call the individual, which they did because I followed up with her, and she said that the 8th District did call her directly. Noise complaints and parkers, as you know, are low priority calls. As we spoke with Sergeant Malloy and as I spoke with Commander, it's at the discretion of the officer. Each situation is different. We weren't there, so we don't know what transpired. We can only go by what the individual says. But after speaking with that person, they were happy with the result. They will continue calling the police department for service regarding blocking the sidewalk and music complaints. So it's an example of us working together with the district to get a resolution on that one. The other one, there's a young lady, I don't want to put her name, Dunjay Park?
Oh,
yeah. Her last name was Miss Dunjay. She lives over off of Colin. Her concern was that she had kids that weren't going to school, drug activity, loud music complaints, people that are parking illegally. And again, this was a coalition of working together. Barb was at the last meeting as well. She took the young lady's information, and I also emailed Commander and Sergeant Malloy with that as well. And we got a response that they will be spending, particularly from Sergeant Malloy, that they'll be adding tactical units to keep an eye on that block for activity. And then Barb followed up with her with informing her that she needed to follow up with DCFS for the children who are just maybe not attending school or whatnot. So again, we had a problem. They had a problem with an issue on the block. They came to us. We presented it to the police department, worked with the ward office. Hopefully, with those solutions, they'll eventually resolve the problem. So this is designed, the 8th District Police Council, if you don't feel comfortable going to a CAPS meeting and talking to an officer directly, us as an elected official, we are here to talk to you guys, take in your problems, present them to the commander, his leadership staff, with the captain, lieutenant, and sergeant, and address those needs for you guys. So if you know anyone who has any issues or complaints, please feel free. You can contact us via email. If you guys have this script here, this one, there is an email address at the very bottom of the first page that you can email us. Or you can ask us directly, and we will give you our email addresses and phone numbers. I have no problem giving you my phone number, and you can call or text me any time of day. So with that being said, we addressed those 2 concerns. Just want to again ask anyone have any concerns, problems? No? That's a good thing. That's good. So we're going to continue on. Hopefully this will be a good, quick meeting. As we continue on, our next order of business is approval of minutes. Every month, our community outreach coordinator is Rosa, who's over there to your left. She notates the minutes from our meetings. Every month we review the minutes, and then we hold a vote to approve documented, posted on the city's website for you guys to review and read at your leisure anytime you want. Anything that you want to find out about the district councils is on the city's website. You can go under Community Commission for Public Safety and Accountability. Under district councils, all 22 district councils are there. Obviously, we're District 8. You click on District 8. And again, you can read about any of our minutes, what we have been doing event-wise. I did a ride-along earlier this year. We did a community survey last year and presented a report to the commander and go from there. So all that's on there. All this is public knowledge. So we approved these meetings. We are approved minutes. We review them. Prior to this meeting, we were presented with minutes from our community outreach coordinator, Rosa, May. And there was no issues or corrections. If anyone's currently reading last month's minutes and they see an issue or a typo or a correction, please let us know and we will make that correction before we make a vote. If there is no issues with the minutes, I make a motion to pass May's minutes. Can I have a second motion? Yes. All right. We will hold a public vote on May's minutes. I vote yes to approve May's minutes. Mark. Aye. And Al is currently not available, so we will just mark him absent at this time. With a 2-0 vote, May's minutes are approved and will be posted within 10 days online to the city's website. One other piece of information that we have to do is January's minutes. Unfortunately, I don't know what happened, but the minutes got misplaced or we don't know what happened, but we have to approve these minutes as well. These minutes are also were on the table for you guys to pick up, read, review. We were presented these earlier in the week to review. I want to make a motion to approve these minutes. Can I have a second? Aye. I vote in favor of approving January's minutes. Mark. Aye. Al is not present, so we'll mark him as absent. January minutes are approved 2-0 with one absent. That will address the minute meetings and go from there. As we continue on, we have our district council reports. Each of us have a specific title position that we have as district councilman. I'm the chairman. Mark here is involved in community engagement, and Al is a nominating person. He deals with the commission and approving vacancies and reviewing applicants for the commission. So I'm going to start off with my report, my chair report. Couple weeks ago, we held our quarterly meeting at Malcolm X College, Wednesday from 5:30 to 8:30. We had a list of proposals. There were 7 proposals on the docket that district councils from various districts across the city presented to the district councils for review. One involved contextual stops from one district councilman. One involved ShotSpotter. One involved merit-based awards and promotions involving that. And there were several others. So we reviewed those, and to have those move forward in the final report in December that will eventually be presented to the commission for review and then ultimately presented to the Chicago Police Department and the superintendent. We have to have at least 7 people approve that proposal, if not more, and then it'll continue on. So we hold these quarterly meetings twice a year, once in the first half of the year and once in the second half of the year. Our next one will be in September. So we hosted one of those quarterly meetings. We also held a, here in the 23rd Ward, last month held a self-defense workshop with Silvana Tavares. for women and young teens. It was well attended. There's about 20, 25 people. We know that the city's getting a little haywire, and we know that anything that you as people can use to get away from an offender, even if it's the simplest thing as a kick to the knee or elbow to the groin and keep you safe, we want you to have that learning and training aspect of it. We're going to do a second one in September or October, but it'll be on the east end of the district, so we can balance it out and go from there. But we've been actively trying to engage community all over the district. As some of you guys know, I thought there was 250,000 people. Last I looked yesterday at the Office of Inspector General, there's 260,000 people there in the 8th district. So 10,000 more than what I thought. So we're trying to do our best to engage you guys as a community. If there's anything that you guys think that we can do better, please let us know. I know it's myself, Mark, and Al. We're just three people. But we also try to work with the commander and his lead staff with different events and meetings to build that bridge between the residents and the community. So moving forward, we will have a meeting. Hello, how you doing? We will have a meeting in July 18th. One of the things that we are actively working on, and I know Barb, I've given you an email, a lot of the local aldermen, I think I presented it maybe to the commander, but we are actively working to try and put pressure on Mayor Johnson to save ShotSpotter here in Chicago. We have an online petition. If you go to ipetitions.com, it's called Keep ShotSpotter in Chicago. Or if you go to our Facebook page, District Council 8, there's a link to go there. Also, if you stop in Silvana Tavares' office, she has hard copies. I wish I had a hard copy on me, but I don't. A hard copy available for you guys to physically sign instead of going online if you're more comfortable doing that. We will have hard copies at next month's meeting, but the reason why I mention that, as Al shows up. As I mentioned that, the reason why I mentioned that, ladies and gentlemen, is we... the reason why I mentioned that, in July 18th, we'll have Sound Thinking, which is the company that is behind ShotSpotter. One of their members will be out talking about ShotSpotter. They'll have data from the 8th District to show how useful it is and why it should be kept here in the city of Chicago and in the wards that collectively have that. I do want to, get the commander's opinion. I always think the commander's opinion is valuable on the technology. Is there a few things you'd like to mention about ShotSpotter and its usefulness?
So, as the commander of the district, my responsibility is public safety. It is not my responsibility for the financial aspect of it. That's where politics comes in, that's where the mayor's office comes in. As far as my personal opinion, I can't give that, I can give my professional opinion. ShotSpotter does a number of things for us. It's another tool in our toolbox. A multitude of things have benefited us. Number one, when ShotSpotter goes off, it can pinpoint an area where the shots were fired, which helps us when we respond to render aid. Yes, sanctity of human life is the Chicago Police Department's number one priority, and it's helped us to get to people and actually save lives. It's also when we get, when you call the police, when you hear shots fired, you may not know exactly where they're coming from because it echoes or where you're located, and you may not have the train here to say, okay, they came two clicks that way or something of that nature. When we can get within that close proximity, we can find the crime scene or the shell casings that may be left behind. We gather those and we send them all off for analysis. And by doing that, we can compare that to other crimes and we can link crimes together. And that's another piece of the puzzle. When we actually get a gun recovered or we get an offender, we can kind of trace things back and it helps us link things together. It's just a multitude of different things. On top of that, when ShotSpotter goes off, our SDSC room, which are the people that monitor the cameras and that, they can start looking in the area for any unusual activity or people's coming or going, and can help responding officers to maybe intercept a vehicle fleeing. That could be someone with an injured person in it that's been shot, or could be the offenders. So my experience with it has been absolutely positive. Is it perfect? No, but there's nothing that's perfect other than Jason Huff and the council here. Other than that, it's been very beneficial. Again, I can't speak to the finance side of it. I can't speak to the public political side of it. I can just say that as a police officer and as a commander of the district, it's very beneficial for us.
Thank you. So again, we've been working diligently on this. The city council just recently approved an ordinance led by Silvana and her colleagues. 34-14 was approved to keep ShotSpotter in the boards that actually currently have it right now. So that's an ordinance. We'll see where it goes, but it did pass. And currently right now, with the online petitions and hard copies, we have about 1,500 signatures. So we're doing pretty well with this petition. If you know anyone who goes online, please forward them to either our Facebook page or the iPetitions.com webpage to keep ShotSpotter in Chicago petition and have them sign it and share it. It's the easiest thing you can do for us to help us to put pressure on the mayor. I know he's adamant about getting rid of it, but hopefully with enough pressure and enough kickback, those wards that do want it can keep it. So that we have been working adamantly on.
Excuse me, I apologize, I had it work. But anyway, so the district council, out of the 66 councilmen, there's about 25 for the ShotSpotter. We have now pleading the cases during our meetings with all the district councilmen. Now that's starting to turn, and there's about 35 people. So more and more, they're seeing their other council members fight for this, and they are starting to understand it. I think education is the number one problem. People don't know. It's not a racial thing. It's about education. And when they find out the reality of this, they're turning to supporting this. So we're trying to get, like Jason said, more and more support throughout the whole city to try to keep this. If it's good enough for the DNC, it's good enough for the residents of Chicago.
So we are, again, we're actively working on this, and again, we hope that you guys can spread the word for us. The biggest thing that anyone can do is just pass it along to a friend and say, hey, check this out for us and sign it. It's free, doesn't cost no money, just pass the word and give them out. You know, that was, like I said, Al said, that's one of the biggest things. You should see our district council meetings or recorded meetings. It's like a city council meeting. There's butting heads, there's arguing half the time. So, but that's what a democracy is. You know, we don't all see eye to eye. We all come from different backgrounds. But we all listen to each other and hopefully come to a common consensus on not only this proposal, but the other ones that were presented. The other couple things I just want to mention, there is a general order that was on the table at the very far end, if some of you guys got it. This is just a order on some rules, some policies and procedures that the CCPSA and the Chicago Police Department are working on how the district and the district councilors are working together, what their responsibilities are, how often they should meet, how often they should talk about issues, and things along that line. This is still a work in progress. This was just put out at our quarterly meeting, so please review it. If you guys have any input or any suggestions on changes, again, please email us. We'll definitely add it to the draft and see if we can make any proposal changes on your behalf as well, because you guys are the voice of us as well. So if you have a chance, review it, read it. Like I said, email us or call us, and we'll definitely add that into the changes. Did you have a question or a comment?
Yeah,
there
is my email on
this. Did you get the script? The script page?
The staple one.
The staple
one? No, they don't have the script. The script
Oh, they don't have a script? Okay. If you guys have a pen. So all our emails, ladies and gentlemen, is our first name. So it's with Jason. It'll be Albert instead of Al. Yeah, Albert, right? That was his email address.
Yeah, it's Albert Cantatola.
So it'll be Albert or Mark. So it's our first name dot our last name. Mine would be Huff, H-U-F-F. Obviously, catch your toes, you know, have fun spelling that last name.
You should be able to look it up online as well.
Send it to Jason Huff.
Yeah. So mine is jason.huff2@cityofchicago.org. If you send it to jason.huff, that goes to my other city work address, and I got to kind of push it to the other, so I don't have a conflict of interest or ethics. But go from there. Same thing with Al. Al is albert.catchtoll2@cityofchicago.org. Mark is markhamlin@cityofchicago.org.
You indicated there was a general one? Or is it just per person?
Oh, normally the city email is your first name dot.
I understand. There's a general one. I don't want to send one to an individual. I'd rather send it generally.
Yeah, it's on here. It's DC008. publiccomment@gmail.com. DC008 publiccomment@gmail.com.
Thank you.
And this comes directly to my email address. I get all emails. I try to respond to them as quickly as possible unless I'm sleeping or at work. And then I will forward them to my colleagues as well so they're informed of what's going on. But any issues, any comments, any suggestions, changes, please email us. And we will respond to you as quickly as possible. The last, yes, Pat.
When you were talking about the district council meeting, are those open to the public?
All meetings are open to the public. All meetings will have public comments, like we had tonight, 2 minutes. And then we will respond to those questions and concerns. If we don't have an answer, then we will take down the information, and they will be responded to as quickly as possible. We have
district council.
Are you asking about the quarterly meeting?
Or yes.
So normally we have, it's usually like news reporters that will come out and kind of stay the day with us, because those meetings are literally from about 10 in the morning, sometimes till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Did you guys have public comment last time?
Yeah, we had public comment. It was open to the public, but like Rose is saying, most of the time it's a news reporter or someone who wants to see what's going on. We haven't had too many people come to the quarterly meetings. But
sometimes they're at night, 7 p.m. to midnight, so it's kind of crazy.
But we're not notified of that. So I guess, I don't know if you don't mind the video that you have, but you know, when we get our email there, when we don't get an email that has to notice it. And I know now that to find out where you guys are meeting, but you don't use our email to notify us.
So that's, we are working on developing a group email. Again, with the city and their technology people. I don't want you guys to think we're blowing you off with emails, but we are working on getting a group email together, so I do my best to try to email everyone I know. I get some of the guys and ladies here on my email blast that I try to send flyers to and updates and whatnot. I know I don't have everyone, but I'm waiting on the IT people from CCPSA to put our group thing in a group district so that we can just email blast you guys. And they go from there, but I don't know how long that's going to take with 22 districts. So same thing with the Facebook. It took us almost.
I almost want to mind, you know, because I do less than 162 people.
And we appreciate that. That's why we send it out to the ward, so because we know they have a bigger database than we do currently. So I apologize about that, but once we do get that database, we will send you guys emails. Yes, sir. Okay. Jump the line. Anyone, with that being said, I do want to just make a brief thing and then turn it over to you. The last thing we did last year was this 2023-2024 community survey. There was about 10 questions on there. We got about a little over 200 responses, which wasn't bad. And we compiled a report for the commander, and eventually the commander will review it and we're responsible, once we get his response, we'll post it for you guys, for you to review and for you to read. With that being said, does anyone have any questions, comments for the commander while he's here? I know he's on a tight schedule.
We have a meeting for 7:18. You say what is it?
We don't have a place yet. We don't have a place yet. But we will have a guy from ShotSpotter there who will talk more about it. We'll have data from Gate District's ShotSpotter and go from there. We're looking at St. Rita over on 63rd in California. If not, maybe Menlo Park. So well, we're trying to go from side to side to service everyone. Anyone have any questions or comments for the commander?
Question for the commander. Is there anything we as citizens could do for these people that run stop signs, run red lights, these go to the left turn lane and then go straight across the road? Is there something we could do to help out?
In all honesty, no, unfortunately, because I don't want to risk anybody's safety. Unfortunately, with chain of custody and whatnot, it wouldn't go anywhere. I will say this, that I've transitioned my team here in the 8th District from, instead of just making contact with people, if need be. I mean, officers always have discretion whether they write a citation or not. I know there was a lot of scrutiny around the traffic stops, but I've told my officers, we have problems. Okay, Pulaski, some of these main corridors, we've had a lot of fatal accidents, and pulling people over and letting them know, hey, you did a violation, and letting them go is not really helpful. So we've transitioned more into citations, when necessary, not always, but a little bit more enforcement that way. Traffic safety is one of our priority problems for the district, so that's definitely being addressed. But again, you know, the level of priority and whatnot, it's kind of difficult. But you know, that is definitely a priority. I've seen it all the time, and it is very, very frustrating. And it's difficult too when they have, you know, improper license plates or different things like that, or they take off and, you know, we're not going to do a pursuit or anything like that for traffic violations. We have policy on that, but we are addressing it. I would like to throw more officers at that, but you know, I'm not able to do it. But I will say that across the city, our citation numbers are really up. I mean, we have a large district. We have a lot of population with the airport, the mall, and the amount of businesses. We're a heavily populated district, not only geographically but populated. And we get a lot of traffic with people coming through. So I do hear and empathize with your concerns, and we are addressing as much as we can.
As a follow-up to that, what is the procedure that your officers follow if they have an unlicensed driver?
Generally, an unlicensed driver will get what they call a traffic violator for bond. I'm not going to steal his thunder with what no bond is and what those procedures are. But in any event, citations are issued and they're going to get appropriate. Whether they're blocked, depending on the circumstances, if it's just no driver's license, no, the car is not confiscated. If they're suspended or if there's a reason for an impound, then the car is taken. There's a very large amount of rules and regulations that, you know, it take me an hour to kind of explain the surface of it.
Thank you.
Sure.
What about those scooters and those little motor buses?
Again, the difficulty is.
Are they supposed to ride on the street or sidewalk?
Really, neither. I mean, there's bike lanes. They can't be in a lane of traffic, but they're still supposed to obey traffic laws. And again, where the problem comes in is everybody in this room can be a reasonable adult and a reasonable driver. You see the police, they turn their lights on, you pull over. Those scooters and whatnot, they don't know they're not supposed to be doing it, they take off. Now, it's a traffic violation, and if I pursue that person, they get an accident and get hurt. I'm at fault, and when I'm at fault, it goes out of all of your pockets because you're taxpayers. So there's a lot of balance. It really infuriates me to see that. We can try, but at the end of the day, there's only so much we can do.
All right, anyone else? All right, we appreciate the commander coming in. I know you don't have him every month, but that's because the district's busy. We don't expect him to be here every month because summer months are really busy. But we do appreciate when he does come in and answer your questions. So, Commander, we appreciate you coming in. Thank you. Anyone else before we let him go?
Just take care of yourself. I know it's a tough job.
I appreciate it. Right? I really do. And I appreciate seeing everybody that comes out that's involved. That really is how change is going to happen. Whether you're coming to the CAPS meetings, whatever your venue is, please come out and get involved. I try as much as I can to learn what's going on in my different communities. I was born and raised in the 8th District, so I have a little bit of a stronghold. But on top of that, it's ever-changing. There's different ethnicities, there's different things that are going on. And just immerse yourself in what's going on, just like our culture with the police department. You know, immerse yourself with finding what's going on. It's easy to throw stones or armchair quarterback, but to actually have a little bit more understanding, you may be like, oh, I see why they did that. You know, a lot of times with police encounters, we don't have the time to explain a lot of what's going on. We just kind of have to take care of business. And I feel that's a disservice to a certain extent, but, you know, time is of the essence. So the more we can be educated about each other and work together, I think the more we're going to get done.
I will say this, and I'm not trying to be biased, but I think we can probably have one of the better commanders throughout the whole city of Chicago, especially since he was here in the 8th District growing up. A lot of these officers, Officer Tracy that you see at the CAPS meetings, he grew up out in Scottsdale. Some of these officers were born and raised here in the 8th District, so it means a lot to them to keep this district safe. So, Commander, we appreciate your hard work. And your time.
Take care. See you all at the next meeting.
Bye.
Yeah,
bye.
Good luck.
Commander?
Thanks for coming out. I appreciate this.
Be safe out there.
Take care. Be safe.
Yep.
As we move forward, our guest speaker tonight is Ben. He's going to speak about the Pre-Trial Fairness Act. I'm not even going to try to explain all that. So I'm just wanting you guys to welcome him. And hopefully you guys have some good questions and comments. If there's something that you'd like addressed, please don't hesitate to ask. Ben, welcome. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate being with you this evening. This is the third one of these district police councils that I've spoken to. I spoke to one on the far north side, one on the west side, and now this one. This is the best attended one that I've been to, and the only one that the commander has been present at. So, you know, give yourselves a hand for that. But just to tell you a little bit who I am and what I'm here to talk about, and I'm much more brief, which is than I usually am, which is a challenge for me, because I tend to be a long-winded person. But my name is Ben Riddell. I am the Director of Criminal Justice Policy for the American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois. So that's the statewide affiliate of the ACLU for Illinois. I'm a lawyer. I'm also a policy advocate that spends a lot of time in Springfield working on state legislation. I've been in this role for about 9 years. Before that, I was a staff attorney for the Illinois House of Representatives for 7+ years, working on criminal justice and firearms issues. The ACLU is a member of a coalition called the Illinois Network for Pretrial Justice, which is a group of about 40 organizations from all over the state. They include law and policy organizations like the ACLU, but also faith-based organizations, community, grassroots organizations, big ones, small ones. All these organizations came together to end money bond in the state of Illinois, which we succeeded in doing as of September 18th of this year. The Pretrial Fairness Act is a law that passed in 2021 and was implemented starting September 18th to end the practice of charging money bond for people's who are accused of crimes and held in jail to gain their freedom. The Pretrial Fairness Act does many more things than end money bond. We have to replace money bond with a new system. And there is not time today to go through all of the aspects of the money bond system. I have a much longer presentation I could give to kind of go through a more comprehensive view. But I do urge you to take this flyer that's on the table that has about 9 what we call key accomplishments of the Pretrial Fairness Act. I'm only going to go through about 2 or 3 of those today. Would urge you to take the time to learn about the other things this law does. So why did we do this? Why was it important to end money bond? Well, Illinois has about 250,000 people pass pass through our jails every year. 90% or so of those people are jailed pre-trial, meaning they haven't been convicted of a crime, they are accused of a crime and entitled to presumption of innocence, which we're all entitled to. And how did the old system work? Well, when a person accused of a crime stepped in front of a judge under the old system, there were about four different outcomes that could happen. One, a person could be released on their own recognizance on what we called an I bond. At the opposite end of the spectrum, it was possible, at least for the most serious crimes, for judges under the old system to hold people without bond. However, that rarely happened. Usually, even when a charge was eligible for no bond detention, what you would see is the prosecutor request a money bond. And the vast majority of cases under the old system involve the court setting a money bond, which is a condition of release. So meaning if the person can come up with that amount of money, they can gain their release. If they are not able to come up with that amount of money, then they remain in jail indefinitely until their trial date. Like I said, this was a condition of release. When a judge sets a money bond, they're saying you're safe to be released if you can come up with the money. Problem is, many people could not come up with the money. You had people sitting in jail for days, weeks, months, sometimes even years at a time, sometimes on charges that were nonviolent, less serious charges. While in other cases, you had people who may pose a concern who were able to put down the money and walk free. This is an inequitable, unfair system. It punished people for being poor. And it was also a really poor way of making public safety decisions. A person's access to money has nothing to do with how dangerous or not dangerous they are, or how likely they are to come back to court or to abscond. But we were allowing people's access to money to stand in for those decisions that judges should be making about whether it's safe to release somebody or not safe to release somebody. So, I should go on and talk about why that's, it's harmful to incarcerate people who don't need to be incarcerated. It's really harmful to spend time in jail, even for a night or two. Your life can quickly unravel. You can lose your job. You can lose your housing. You can lose access to benefits and education. People even lose custody of their children after short periods of pretrial incarceration. All of this is extremely destabilizing to their lives, their families' lives, their kids who depend on them, and the communities they live in. And none of this makes us safer. In fact, the people who spend time in jail pre-trial are more likely to be arrested in the future. So we're kind of creating crime when we overuse jails and destabilize people's lives. And when you think about how destabilizing it is to be in jail, it makes sense that would the experience of being in jail would lead to a higher rate of arrest in the future, which it does statistically. What are jails for? What are the legitimate legal constitutional reasons we have jails? One is to ensure that people return to court, that they don't abscond, and the second is to protect the public, to make sure that people who there's a reason to believe may harm somebody are not able to do so, and to hold them in jail for public safety reasons. And so that's what the Pretrial Fairness Act focuses courts on. Rather than determining some arbitrary amount of money that's going to determine whether somebody's released from jail or stays there, money is taken out of the equation, and instead the court is focused on risk. That is, the risk that somebody is going to willfully flee, not come back to court, or the risk that they are going to put to do harm to another person. One of the things that the Pretrial Fairness Act does beyond abolishing money bond is it limits eligibility for pretrial incarceration, at least in the first instance. So I think I want to first kind of preface this by saying, somebody who's already under some sort of supervision because they're on probation, probation, they're on parole, or they're on pretrial release from a prior arrest. These rules don't really apply to them because, you know, if you're already subject to one of those things and you commit a crime, even a lower level crime, you may be jailed for that. But so when I'm talking about these rules, really think about somebody who's not on probation, parole, or you know, under current legal supervision for some other crime or accusation. So for the very lowest crimes, your ordinance violations or low-level misdemeanors, you know, littering, things like that, the act basically, you know, says no custodial arrest. We give a ticket, you know, and it's similar to a traffic ticket. It's got a court date on it. Come back to court. And if you don't do that, you know, there are consequences, but these are for things that people were, by and large, not being arrested for even before this law passed or taken into custody for. In the sort of mid-level, the Class A misdemeanors and low-level felonies, with some exceptions, the officer, the arresting officer, has the option. They can issue a summons for court, or they can take the person into custody and a custodial arrest, and they stay there in jail until they see the judge. And then finally, in the, you know, the higher level charges, all the other felonies, you know, those proceed as normal in terms of what the arresting officer does. And the person, you know, is held over until the next opportunity to go to what used to be called bond court. You know, now it is the first appearance. And the first thing that the court determines is, you know, as they did under the old system, is there probable cause to believe this person committed this offense? Second, is it a charge that is eligible for detention? And then the fact that the charge is eligible for detention isn't the end of the story. The prosecutor needs to make a decision. Do they want this person to be detained in jail, or do they not want the person to be detained? If they don't ask for detention, then the court will move right to determining what the conditions of release are. Is there going to be a curfew, a stay away order, other conditions, drug testing, things like that, that the person has to abide by while they're on pretrial release. But if the prosecutor does want that person detained, then they have to make some showings. They have to tell the court why this individual they believe poses a risk of doing harm to others, a risk to the community if they're released, or a risk of willful flight, why they think this person is likely to abscond and not come back to court. If they're able to meet the requisite standard and convince the judge that one of those two things are true, then the judge will order that the person be detained. If they fail to meet that burden, then the judge will say, I'm sorry, we're not going to detain this individual, we're going to determine conditions of release, and then they'll move to that segment of the hearing. And so, you know, all of this is meant to ensure that, like, to minimize the use of pretrial incarceration to the times when it's really necessary on serious charges, not less serious charges, and to ensure that we're not shooting ourselves in the foot by causing more crime and destabilizing our communities through the overuse of jails. Since this has been implemented since September 18th, it seems to be working. The jail populations around the state are substantially reduced, and we're not seeing the crime increases that were forecast by the people who the doubters or opponents of this law, and you know, there were a lot of them. The reason the law didn't go into effect until September 18th of this year was because of some lawsuits that were filed that had to go move their way through the court system, and you know, ultimately the Illinois Supreme Court said they upheld this law, found that it complies with the Constitution, and so here we are. We're more than 6 months into implementation, actually almost closer to a year into implementation, And you know, it's the act appears to be working as it should. But I know there's a lot of different information out there, some misinformation out there about the Pretrial Fairness Act. This is a very general overview I'm giving you, and so I know in the brief, the few minutes that we have left really of this meeting, I want to hear what your questions are and see if I can answer them.
I got a couple for you. You mentioned data and reducing crime. Who oversees, I mean, like the police department's got 11 agencies that currently oversee them. Who oversees your data collection, and who's determining if this is a success? You mentioned that it's there hasn't been an influx of crime, but if you watch, we watch the news on a daily basis, we see crimes downtown, we see crimes in the suburbs, we see crime all over the state. So who's the agency, or who is the people that are determining this data and determining that this is not, that this is actually lowering crime or not increasing it?
Well, I think, you know, the when I talk about crime going up and down, I'm talking about the publicly reported crime stats that come from law enforcement. But when I talk about the fact that jailing somebody actually statistically increases their chance of being arrested in the future, that's from, you know, studies that have been done in, you know, other jurisdictions. I don't have at my fingertips what those studies are, but I could find them and give them to you. But in terms of who does the data collection around the Pretrial Fairness Act, the final thing, number 9 on this sheet, is about data collection, and it's actually the court system is mandated to collect data about what kinds of, you know, how many people are coming before the courts, how many of those are the prosecutors asking for detention? Are they asking for detention for safety reasons, for willful flight? What are the charges? What are the demographics of the people? And what's the outcome? Are they being detained or are they not being detained? And are they successful on pretrial release or is it violated? So this is data that the courts have been mandated to collect. I will tell you the courts are behind in collecting the data. I think we have 100 and some circuits all the court clerks in these different counties doing things the different ways. And so getting everybody on the same page to report the data in a way that is comparable, comparing apples to apples, the courts have been slow in complying with that mandate, and we want to see them get up to speed as soon as they can. Yes,
how about data on return offenders? Return offenders. Mm-hmm. So I let Joe Blow out of the out. And now Joe Blow commits another crime, so I didn't hear any data about that.
Yeah, the Pretrial Fairness Act mandates the collection of rearrest data.
Rearrest data.
I have some data. So, I guess just to overarch, my name's George Devereaux. I've lived in the 8th District my entire life also. So, I got like 5 instances where people were released on felony cases where they've gone out to do violent offenses. So May 5th, 2024, a male fired into a car at 1600 block of North Cicero Avenue. 3 people were shot in a car. What about the victims from these crimes? Excuse me, sir.
Okay.
May 4th, 2024, a male shot and killed a person in his home. 9800 South Block of Hoxie. He was on pretrial release for a felony PCS case. April 5th, 2024, a male shot 3 people on the 200 block of East Garfield. Pretrial for release for a felony DUI case. Not a violent crime, right? March 31st, a male shot 4 people, 1 fatally, 4900 West Block of Ferdinand. Pretrial release for a felony UW case. March 12th, 2024, male arrested unlawful use of a weapon case. If you traveled on a CTA train, he was also charged from a January 31st murder, which occurred on the 8,000 block of South Cottage. He was on a pretrial release for a felony UUW case. February 9th, female charged for kidnapping, murder of a Rockford car dealer. On pretrial release for felony aggravated battery of a police officer. So who speaks for the victims, essentially? I mean, Mr. Kwame Raoul, he increases the amount of victims' compensations for victims of crimes. Not really too concerned about like doing things prior to people being arrested or keeping people within in the system or in incarceration until their cases are resolved. You know, there are over people that have been released 2024 for violent crimes, murder, attempt murder, aggravated battery. 21 people have gone out to offend again that were on pretrial release. I guess the accountability component of it, right? So what Mr. Huff was stating, that police officers are scrutinized to the umpth degree with oversight. A judge lets somebody out. What's happened to a judge? Has a judge ever been removed from the bench for like a letting a person out that goes out and kills somebody as a result of their decision? How about a prosecutor? Does a prosecutor get punished or admonished for letting somebody out on pretrial release and they go out and kill somebody? They don't. So this is ridiculous. I mean, I'm a walking victim, essentially, because I'm not going to be doing any crimes out here. So this has really no benefit to me. It only has downside. And I'm not even talking about people going out and doing, like, nonviolent crimes. The amount of, like, property damage crimes that these individuals commit on pretrial release, and we're supposed to just take that and not say anything about it? I think it's a problem. You know, I mean, we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. There's obviously documented instances where people go out and harm people as a result of the Safety Act. And now, Mr. Slaughter, our Illinois state representative, introduced House Bill 277. How do you feel about this, too? Letting people go with 3 moving violations in a year? Our insurance rates are going to go out through the roof? These are all ridiculous, nonsensical things. People have to be held accountable for their actions.
Thank you for that comment. I think it's important to point out that people on pretrial release, under the Pretrial Fairness Act, doesn't eliminate crime. It doesn't wave a wand and, you know, the crime that existed under the old money bond system suddenly goes away. People on pretrial release committed crimes at the same or maybe higher rate under the money bond system. The money bond system didn't keep us safe. We're not creating, this is not to be compared to a perfect system that doesn't exist and has never existed. It's to be compared to the money bond system that we had for years, which didn't even consider questions of safety or willful flight. It just considered how much money somebody had. It was a bad way of making decisions. A better way of making decisions is having judges ask, does this person pose a risk? Does this person of harming somebody else, does this person pose a risk of absconding and not coming back to court? Now, they're not always going to get it right. Judges are not clairvoyant, but about 90%+ of people who are released on pretrial status do not commit further crimes. They succeed. I would ask you, would you have all those people be held in jail until their trial dates?
I would, and it worked for family members for me. It's worked. When they're in jail, they're not committing crimes. So tell that to the victim of the person who's let out for a felony offense on pretrial release, and they get shot, or, you know, God forbid, murdered. Tell that to them. I mean, this is all well and good, but if you're not a victim, then you're not impacted by it. But we can help people from stopping to become victims. That's what we can do with keeping them waiting for their court case to be resolved.
I appreciate your point of view, sir. I just want to return to the point that when we overuse jail, we increase the likelihood that people are going to commit crimes and be arrested in the future. We're not helping ourselves public safety-wise by destabilizing the lives and the families. You know, the innocent people who depend on those people who go to jail, are their parent is now in jail. And so what do you think is going to happen to those folks? It has a spillover effect. We're damaging our own public safety when we destabilize our communities unnecessarily, holding people in jail who didn't pose a danger in the first place.
I get something to say.
I would like clarification on something that's kind of a two-part thing. If a person is denied bond, they have the right to appeal that decision. Where are they physically at until that appeal comes up?
If they were ordered detained, they are in jail.
Okay.
You have the second part to it?
That was the second part.
Okay. Mark?
Yeah, I was going to say, his feet on. What's your name back there, sir?
My name's George Devereaux.
George. I got to agree with it. Some of this stuff, this is just my personal opinion. You had a young man that carjacked 10 people. He's constantly has been let out. Now, I consider that a menace to society. I love my seniors here. I love my young people. Some of that blame needs to fall on the judge. Without even throwing law into it, just common sense. If that comes across your day, your desk, and you see this pattern going on and on and on, something needs to be done. That person doesn't need to be out. If we know he's carjacked somebody, and that was in the paper, this guy has done 10 carjackings in a row. So are we supposed to give him cake and ice cream and just let him do whatever he wants?
Well, certainly not. I think if a person's on pretrial release for a carjacking and they're arrested again, forget it. They're even not even. It's their first one. They have no record. Carjacking is a detainable offense. A judge can detain somebody.
Well, this guy was walking the street
after the time.
Carjacking after carjacking after carjacking. Well, some's got to stop him now.
I got a question.
Yeah.
If somebody gets released on this pretrial bill here, Fairness Act, they commit a crime, can they be released again on this Fair Trial Act.
So they're on pretrial release and they get arrested again.
Yes.
They, depending on what it is.
See, but that's where,
yes.
That's where it's wrong. All right, we'll give you a get out of jail card for you.
But
now you did it again.
But it's not, sir, because you know, for anything that somebody is on pretrial release status on, they can be jailed as a sanction for violating that pretrial release, including by, you know, on top of being charged with a new crime, they can be sent to jail for the violation of their pretrial release. I'm telling you, you asked, like, can they be released? And I'm saying they can because they don't have to be sent to jail. This isn't a law that mandates what judges have to do in every instance, but it gives them the tools to do that in every instance.
Okay, so let's expound on that a little bit more. Then why can't the people behind this put in there and say, okay, Jimmy, we're going to let you out this time, but you do it again, now you're locked up.
Because that's the judge's job.
Well, maybe it should be the job of making this act the right fairness to what George said.
Right.
You know, to now as a victim, okay, well, you did it wrong the first time. But now you did it wrong the second time. Now you're going to be locked up.
Yeah.
I'm just talking as, you know, a person that's not committing a crime.
Yeah, it's really hard for legislatures to legislate what a correct outcome should be in every case, you know. And usually they get it wrong. You know, that's how we end up with mandatory minimums that give us mass incarceration, because it's a judge, it's the legislature trying to substitute its judgment for judges who listen to the facts and have that individual before them and have that victim before them and consider what actually occurred and lay down an appropriate sentence. We get into a lot of trouble when legislatures, you know, in politically charged environments say, well, you know, we're gonna like try and make sure everybody gets, you know, hammered who does wrong. Because it's an election year, right? And that's how we end up with a lot of the laws that we have.
Anyone else have comments or questions?
is there any, I can't think of the word, but is there any look back at the judges and to what determination for the sentence that they give for this free trial?
No. I think that's what I was going at too, was at the end of the day, we have 11 agencies looking at the police department. The accountability factor, if these individuals, these judges and these prosecutors, at the end of the day, what agency or what person is overseeing this to make changes or hold these people accountable for making the decisions of letting people out that may recommit crimes? Same thing with the electronic monitoring. We see a lot of times in social media news, gentleman was out on electronic monitoring, was wound up committing a severe crime, a carjacking, a robbery. You know, at the end of the day, I think a lot of people don't mind giving low-level crime people a chance, but who's holding those people accountable if we're holding the police department to such a high standard?
Voters. Voters who elect state's attorneys and sheriffs and judges. You asked a question about data collection and sort of, you know, the public, needs to be watchful of, like, you know, what their elected officials are doing from the bench or from the state's attorney's office or from the sheriff's office. But ultimately, those are elected officials, and it's the public who hires and fires them.
At election time, when the judges are up for election, the American Bar Association puts out a report of judges that they approve or they do not approve. And that's one way to get some of these judges out, if they're letting people go that they should not be.
So the word is to get that out to the voters,
yes,
to say, hey,
yes,
don't vote for these guys.
Right.
And anyone else have questions or comments? No? Ben, we appreciate you coming down here tonight. Let's give them a round of applause for coming out and talking to you guys. If you guys have any questions or would like to talk to them, I'm sure we'll be around for a few minutes after the meeting to talk to them. Again, we appreciate you guys coming out. We're going to just end this by asking if there's any questions, comments, anything else that's come up before we leave out. No? Okay. Any questions on Facebook Live? Rosa? Comments? No? All right, guys. Without any further business, we're going to make a motion to adjourn. All right, the meeting's adjourned at 7:40. Next month's meeting will be July 18th, 6:30. We will have the gentleman from ShotSpotter out to talk about ShotSpotter.